Good afternoon once again. It was a cold and eventful week. This week I used an expression that might be common in our culture, but it was expressed with meaning. I made the comment to an individual, "What is our world coming to?" And like I said, that is an expression that I'm sure we have heard used or have used by people for various reasons. But I'll give you the context of that particular expression. As you know, we're building a building and I'm working with different contractors, and I was working with Troyer Flooring. The owner of the company's name is Conrad Troyer, and he had told me on Tuesday that he would stop by to see me. And as I came to the end of the day, I thought, Conrad didn't show up. And it was like, well, that's kind of unusual for him not to show up. So I texted him and said, "Are you coming by today?" And he said, "No, I'll be there tomorrow. We had a rather eventful day, and I had not been listening to the news because I was busy." And what had occurred on Monday evening or Monday night or Tuesday morning at 2 o'clock, I guess, to be more exact, there was a murder that occurred in Dundee, Ohio, which is just 5 miles up the road. Things like that are not supposed to happen in our part of the world, and we've had two recent events like that. As it turns out, the perpetrator ended up in a standoff with the officials outside Conrad Troyer's house. So he had 12 cops sitting outside his house in a standoff with this individual starting at 2:30 in the morning until he took his own life at 7:30 in the morning. And so my comment was, what is our world coming to? I mean, obviously killings and those kinds of things are not new to our world, but it is becoming a ever more frequent event, certainly with the recent murder that we had in Strasburg, Ohio, of the Chumneys. And of course, fortunately, those individuals have been apprehended. But the question, what is our world coming to? I would like to, in the sermon today, go through a, shall we say, lesson of history and draw some contrasts. The title of the sermon this afternoon is "The Tyranny of Independence from Divine Providence." The tyranny of independence from divine providence. Now, the notion of independence is something that we hold dear in this country, and so we should. But again, as I said, I'd like to go through a lesson of history and draw some contrasts. And I think while certain conditions have always existed, I understand that. I think if we look at the general statistics of then and now, we will see major differences, actually a huge goal. So I'd like to take us back to the founding of our nation, and in particular to the organizational document, if you will, of the Declaration of Independence that was used back in 1776. And I think it will stand in stark contrast to the complacency with which our current culture looks at events today. I dare say that the tenor of the day was different back in 1776, because daring men signed their death warrants to a document of ideals that would chart not only the course of human events, but rather the course of the history of the world for the next two centuries. You know, it is indisputable that the United States has, particularly in the century just passed, been the primary influence when it comes to world history. But their success back then was not a foregone conclusion at all. It was a daring endeavor and a, shall we say, fragile adventure. It could have come out very differently from what ended up happening and we take today as a foregone conclusion. So I'm going to read some quotes and then I'm going to read contrasting quotes so that we get the contrast between then and what our world has come to today. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Continuing, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, those three things we see bandied about all the time. Life, liberty, or the redefinition of liberty, should we perhaps say, as has happened particularly in the last 50 or so years. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That was a radical notion at that time. That somehow the governments instituted among men would gain their rights from those governed. They were in a culture and in a time when the monarchs of Europe still believed in the divine right of kings, that God somehow endowed a monarch with the not only the right, but not only the ability, but the right to govern nations. And they could, as human beings do, excuse all kinds of abusive and dictatorial behaviors in the fact that, you know, God allowed me to do this, so since I am endowed by God with the right to rule, well, since he didn't prevent me from doing these things, it must be the will of God. I mean, that was the kind of reasoning that was going on at that time. So this was radical, very radical. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that the United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. Now notice the concluding statement. And for the support of this declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. That was the tenor. That was the culture. That was the belief system and structure upon which our country was founded, that established the liberties that we have enjoyed for a couple hundred years. Now, I'd like to highlight some of the things that we just read that will begin to draw a contrast, that will, I believe, what we will come to is what the title of the sermon suggests, that to be independent from divine providence is tyranny, not liberty. Note some of the highlights. Number one, we read the quote that nature's God entitles them. Now, you can read through that, but notice that is very different from the God in nature, or that nature becomes a God unto itself. It was nature's God. Number two, notice that all men are created equal. And back then, people were still educated enough to understand that men refers to mankind, and it didn't have to say him or her. It's one of my pet peeves. It does not say that all men evolved to equality. Our organizational document stated that, and one of the justifications for writing it, appealed to the fact that all men are created equal. They didn't evolve to equality. That was one of the unalienable rights that God endowed men and women with. Number three. The unalienable rights are endowed to men by their Creator, not by and from men. You know, we as human beings didn't get these unalienable rights because we obtained them from some earthly legislative body or from, well, that is to say, from other men. It is something that we gain by virtue of birth as a human being from God, the document stated. Number four, they relied on the protection of divine providence. Not in the implements of war, although they used those mechanisms. And number five, they committed their lives, fortunes, and honor. They were by definition men instead of cowards that would cave to the latest pandering of human society. You see, that is a defining difference between the realization and the understanding and the belief that we are on this earth for a purpose, and that we have been given that purpose by a benevolent God, as opposed to being some freak of nature that just happens to occur in the eons of time, in the billions of years that Earth has existed, and we're on just some continuum, a life without purpose. Actually, I think I have a quote to that effect, if I can find it quickly. I can't. The quote that I read earlier this morning said that with the abolition of religion, it also dispenses with the purpose of life. I mean, it's just one of those dynamics that happens. I mean, you have a very different perspective on life if you believe in a creator than if you believe you are the product of some natural process. Let's go over to, we'll be heading to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, but I wanted to read something here to you. When you read the document the quotes that we just read, if you look at it objectively, one could conclude correctly that it is as much a declaration of dependence on divine providence as it is a declaration of independence from tyranny of absolutism. They depended, the rationale was based on the fact that God existed, and they were relying on him to make their adventure a success. That was the founding premise. This text provides also a substantial insight into the basis for the document that would chart the course of world history. It rests firmly on the recognition of God and the belief that he would guide by divine providence. Stated simply, it was an act of faith. I find it interesting, the statement, we find these truths, or we hold these truths to be self-evident. Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, is one of those key scriptures that I want to refer to in this context. But without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. This is a powerful promise and a equally frightening reprimand if we do not believe. If we believe God exists, and that he is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him, we will please him. And he will reward us. If we don't, and if there is no basis for belief, if we do not believe, we have no basis to please divine providence and to seek his favor. So now what I'd like to do is to, again, quote some historical documents and draw some contrasts. So here we have a quote from the first session of Congress, and this is from a book entitled The Christian Life and Character of Civil Institutions of the United States, and I'm quoting from page 246. And this is the first thing that they did on September 6, 1774. Resolve that the Reverend Mr. Ducey be desired to open Congress tomorrow morning with prayer at Carpenter's Hall at 9 o'clock. That's the first recorded act of Congress that we start with prayer. Now, you just begin to think about, where we're at in public discourse when it comes to prayer. And then it was recorded on September 7th that he actually did the prayer. And John Adams, in a letter to his wife, said this about the scene. When the Congress first met, Mr. Cushing first made a motion that it should be opened with prayer. It was opposed by one or two because we were so divided in the religious sentiments. Some were Episcopalians, some Quakers, some Anabaptists, some Presbyterians, and some Congregationalists, that we could not agree in the same act of worship. So the issue was not whether or not a prayer should be uttered or offered up. The issue was, since we have such a diverse group here, who would do it? And remember, we have to look at the context of the events. The Church of the, I should say the monarchs of England did not have that problem because there was the state church, and only a representative from the state church of England would be able to offer a prayer, and neither did the monarchs of Europe because they had a church-state combination, so there was never any dispute. The whole notion, actually, of separation of church and state was first debated in Switzerland by my forefathers, the Anabaptists, who, ironically, were part of this first event, according to Adams. Now, here's what he said, or rather, I should say, Mr. Samuel Adams said this: "I am no bigot, and could hear a prayer from a gentleman of piety and virtue who was at the same time a friend of his country." And because of that statement by Samuel Adams, it was agreed then to have Mr. Ducci, the prayer of which I will read in a moment, for him to offer it up despite the diversity. So here's a contrast. This comes from a book entitled The Death of the West by Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan is a controversial individual, but I find what he writes here to be instructive. This is from page 183. "How was America de-Christianized?" The answer: tyrannically. You see, the Judeo-Christian ethic, properly applied and lived, I should say maybe more appropriately, lived, leads to liberty and life. Life eternal, I might add. The contrast to that is tyranny. So the methodology should not surprise us. It was tyrannically. And with surprisingly, here's the sad thing, with surprisingly small resistance from a people whose forebears rank among history's fiercest enemies of undemocratic rule. Continuing, going back 50 years, the Supreme Court has inflicted an almost uninterrupted string of defeats about faith, the faith of our fathers. Here are the string of defeats. In 1948, voluntary religious instruction was outlawed in public schools. In 1962, school prayer went. In 1963, voluntarily daily reading from the Bible was declared unconstitutional. Notice the progression. In 1948, it became unconstitutional to give religious instruction, but you could still read from the Bible. In 1962, they dispensed with prayer. Now, wait a minute. You notice the contrast? The first act of Congress was to offer up a prayer. In 1962, we decided that that is unconstitutional. Think about the jump in logic. The framers of the very Constitution upon which the Supreme Court called upon to justify the abolition of prayer in school started their first meeting. The very first act was with prayer. Now, we can get all fired up about this, and I become passionate speaking about it, but the issue that this author points out is that all this occurred with very little resistance from those who should have cared. The Christians should have cared, but we did nothing. We went along with it. In 1980, a Kentucky law that called for the posting the Ten Commandments on the classroom walls was overturned because the commandments serve no secular purpose. Really? Don't the Ten Commandments contain a statement, I seem to remember, you shall not murder? That has no secular benefit? I mean, there is, as all tyrannical forms of government and dictates, there is no logic. There is no logical connection between the two. To argue that the Ten Commandments have no secular, this is a quote from the, court order. Has no secular purpose. You shall not steal has no secular purpose. You shall not murder has no secular benefit. So now we go back to the prayer of 1777. Here is what the Reverend Ducci said before the First Congress began any activity. I quote an excerpt. Quote, O Lord, our Heavenly Father, high and mighty King of Kings, and Lord of Lords, who does from thy throne behold all the dwellers on earth, and reignest with power supreme and uncontrolled over all the kingdoms, empires, and governments, look down in mercy, we beseech thee, on these American states who have fled to thee from the rod of the oppressor. They were being oppressed because they taxed tea. You know, I wonder what they would say today. Today they tax you coming and they tax you going at every level of government. And thrown themselves, so they fled the rod of a tyrannical oppressor, and what did they do? And have thrown themselves on thy gracious protection, desiring to be henceforth dependent only on thee. All this we ask in the name and through the merits of Jesus Christ, your Son, our Savior. Amen. And that's from Thatcher's military biography. That's how it started. We are now reaping the benefits of a misinterpretation of the Constitution that says the Ten Commandments have no secular purpose. And the irony of this is that the Supreme Court sits in a building where the Ten Commandments are engraved on their very building. And they outlaw it to be in other courtrooms and schools around the world. I mean, this should get our attention, but it hasn't. Because we've become complacent and cowardly as citizens of the country. And again, it's just a result of a constant planned acculturation. As this book puts it, the de-Christianization or the secularization of the United States of America. And the end result is predictable. Let's look at another quote. This is from Franklin. It's one of my favorites. This now, it goes forward 10 years to 1787 at the Continental Convention. Mr. Franklin stated, quote, we have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings that, quote, except the Lord built the house, they labor in vain who build it. We have a hymn about that quote. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. We shall be divided by our little partial local interests, by petty partisanism, which is so evident today, Our projects will be confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and byword down to future ages. And as history records, at this critical juncture, it was Franklin that somehow, I mean, he had the strength of character and the influence that was necessary to get the petty arguments that were present even at that time to unite and to come together. What did he, you know, what did he go to? What did he use to make his, to frame his argument? The sacred writings. He didn't think, apparently, that the building of the Tower of Babel was a fable. He used it to demonstrate what happens to any organization if you have this kind of controversy. And by appealing to the principles of the sacred writings, which they had stated earlier were self-evident, I mean, accepted as self-evident truth, I mean, that was the thing that united people. That was the one thing they could agree on. Where are we at today? I found this paragraph to be interesting, okay? Let's look at a terrible event in history that is 100 years ago, the First World War. In the Great War of 1914 to 1918, Catholic France fought Catholic Austria. Onward Christian soldiers. 9 million quote-unquote Christian soldiers died on the battlefield. And Protestant Germany fought Protestant England. Christian soldiers marched to their death, yet only, and here's the thing I found to be insightful, yet only Orthodox Russia succumbed to a communist revolution. Even though you had Christian warriors fighting each other, and which was wrong, at the end of the war, liberty prevailed. In Russia, that was not the case. So, there was a guy by the name of Gramsci who said, well, you know, Gramsci concluded that 2,000 years of Christianity had made the soul of Western man impenetrable to Marxism. And of course, he thought that was a bad thing. Before the West could be conquered, its faith must be uprooted, and here was the methodology. That they would cooperate with progressives to capture the institutions that shape the souls of the young. Go after the young in the schools, colleges, movies, music, arts, and the new mass media. And then when after several generations this was accomplished, the West would no longer be the West, but another civilization altogether. And control of the state would inevitably follow control of the culture. Culture determines organizational, individual, and national performance in action. So here's where we're at. But as Christianity began to die in the West, something else occurred. Western peoples began to stop having children. For the correlation between religious faith and large families is absolute. The more devout a people, whether Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, the higher its birth rate. In New Square, New York, In the first Holy Orthodox Jewish community in the United States, the average family has 10 children. As goes the family, so goes the culture. And the article goes on to talk about, you know, we've had less children in the West. We have aborted more. It creates a vacuum. And as we read in the Old Testament scripture, the alien rises higher and higher among you because the demands of the workforce and so on and so forth require someone to fill that. Wherever secularism triumphs, populations begin to shrink and die. Why? Because secularism is dead. It leads to death, not to life and liberty as advertised. Another quote. What do you think the Congress was doing on the 11th of September, 1777? Well, actually, what was happening is the Battle of Brandywine was going on, and it was so close to the Congressional Hall that they could hear the cannons. They ordered 30,000 Bibles from Scotland. The reason assigned was that the use of the book was so universal and important. Again, what was happening on that day, the Army of Washington was fighting the Battle of Brandywine. 1,200 soldiers were killed that day. And yet it was important, in this important hour, Congress was passing an order for the importing of thousands of Bibles. Yet we never heard that they were charged by their generation of any attempt to unite church and state. Let's take a look at the contrast. G.K. Chesterton said this about mere tolerance. I mean, tolerance is or has become our highest virtue. He said, quote, "The virtue of men who no longer believe mere tolerance, quote, is the virtue of men who no longer believe in anything. And consequently, anything goes. But here's the result. Our new faith is tolerance only about what it considers inconsequential. Here's the list. Sex, pornography, filthy language, boorish manners, slovenly dress, and obscene art. Now that sounds pretty tolerant. I mean, we can't have the Ten Commandments in any public building. We can't have that, but we can have all of this, and it's considered art. However, here's the kicker. The kicker is that while we tolerate everything, here's what we can't tolerate. It has no tolerance for those who defy its secularist dogma. For example, a local druggist may sell condoms to a 13-year-old, but sell cigarettes to the same kids and you will be prosecuted for endangering their health and imperiling their morals. Now, think about that logic. You know, what is, I mean, I'm not espousing smoking, but I think it is more dangerous to encourage promiscuous behavior than smoking, at least in the short term. Books that proclaim that God is dead, or that St. Paul was homosexual, or that the celibacy is crippling, or that Pius the Seventh was Hitler's pope, will attract warm reviews for boldness, creativity, but slip in and use a racial slur as Senator Byrd did, or a vulgarism about homosexuals as Dick Armey famously did, and you will not escape the whipping post. So, you know, why one and not the other? It's because the virtue of intolerance is, the virtue of tolerance, rather, I should say, is, on the other hand, is very intolerant of anything that is inconsistent with what they believe. Okay, here's, we jump forward to 1813. So time has passed by. This is a letter from former President Adams to Thomas Jefferson. The general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity, he says. I will avow that I then believed and now believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God. It was natural law. Here's the contrast. Those who believe the gay rights movement is the 21st century civil rights movement miss a basic difference. The civil rights cause could successfully invoke the Bible, natural law, and Thomas Jefferson on behalf of equal justice under the law. Now, those are some pretty big ticket items. You can invoke Thomas Jefferson, natural law, and the Bible on the issue of civil rights. Gay rights cannot. Jefferson considered homosexuality worse than bestiality. As governor of Virginia in 1779, he urged the same punishment for sodomy as for rape. This is a huge contrast. We are now using the Constitution, of which Jefferson was at least in one of the primary authors, to call it an unalienable right. It's an alternative lifestyle. But you can't use natural law, nor can you invoke the Bible, at least not legitimately or rightly, to substantiate this argument. We are skating on thin ice. The Bible, Catholic doctrine, and natural law hold the practice to be abhorrent, and a society that embraces it to be decadent. Christians are to reform such society or separate from them. In the letter from a Birmingham jail, Martin Luther King wrote, quote, "A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God." You know, Martin Luther King was a primary personality in the civil rights movement, and this was his basic premise. Independence from divine providence ends in tyranny. It is a natural law. And you can try to avoid the consequence, but you cannot escape the results. Let's take a look at some of the results. One in four children born to white women are out of wedlock. That's 25% now. In 1960, before we became enlightened, it was 2%. And I might add that birth control was not as readily available at that time. Three in four unmarried white women have had affairs by age 19. In 1900, the figure was percent. Again, you know, I'm drawing on these statistics. We're not talking about a difference between 6% and 8%. We're talking about a difference between 6% and 75%. Something has changed. And again, to go back to, we have largely gone along with it as a church, as individuals, because we are constantly bombarded with those kinds of ideas. Teen suicides are triple what they were in the early 1960s. Test scores of high school students are now among the lowest in industrialized nations. We keep changing the curriculum so that we dumb it down so that everybody can have an A. It doesn't work that way. And it won't work in society. As an employer of a number of people, it is a major problem. I mean, I have what we call the three C's. You have to come in on time, clean up after yourself, and count. And you would be surprised at the number of people that can't get those three things right. The U.S. divorce rate is up 350% since 1962, and one-third of all American children now live in single-parent homes. Nearly 2 million Americans are in jails or prisons, 4.5 million on probation or parole. In 1980, the prison and jail population was 500,000. So it's quadrupled since 1980. This doesn't sound like liberty and life and the pursuit of happiness. It sounds like tyranny, like slavery and oppression. In the African American community, 69% of all births are out of wedlock. Two-thirds of the children live in single-parent homes. 28% of the boys can expect to serve a jail or prison sentence. In major cities, 4 in 10 black males aged 16 to 35 are in jail or in prison or are on probation or parole. Drugs are pandemic. This is tyranny, oppression, not liberty and life. I think these quotes have demonstrated the centrality, on the one hand, of dependence on divine providence and the tyranny of independence from it. Now, we could wax eloquent about the seismic departure and be a Monday morning quarterback about where our country is going. Like I said, what has happened to our world? What has happened to the world we live in? We could elaborate on the eradication of the Bible and its principles from public life. We could decry the abomination of abortion that sacrifices millions of unborn on the egocentric altar called the right to choose. We could lament over the failed policies of our now secular government. But far more important, it seems to me, is to challenge ourselves with a personal question. And I've asked this one before. Some years ago, it occurred to me, you know, have we, you know, could we or should we write a personal declaration of dependence on divine providence? You know, do we really recognize how dependent we are on God for everything? You know, in our modern sophisticated world, I mean, we have been able to technologically control the elements a lot more. And as technology increases, we begin to think our dependence on God is lessened, when in fact that is not the case. What would a personal declaration of dependence on divine providence look like? I'm going to conclude this sermon by going over to Psalm chapter 51, because I think it provides us a model. Psalm chapter 51. Here we have David appealing to divine providence and depending on his gracious mercies after having violated several of the Ten Commandments, who the Supreme Court has concluded now has no secular purpose. It did back then, and it does today, because based on the statistics I just read about children out of wedlock and single homes, and you know, I'm not unaware of the difficulties and the challenges of raising kids in that situation, but it is a consequence. And I will just offer this. It will lead to tyranny, because we now look to the government to provide a solution to that problem, instead of where we should look to, and that is what David did, to the divine mercies of God, to forgiveness, to restitution, to forgiveness and the ability to move forward. The government can, of necessity, can only solve these problems, and it is not even a solution, it is a coping mechanism, and the only way they can do that is by providing money, and it will, of necessity, require oppression of others. Because money, contrary to what some seem to believe, doesn't grow on trees, and you can't print enough money in Washington to solve these problems. It just won't work. We can say what we want. I mean, it won't work. Psalm chapter 51. I mean, the amazing thing about David, I mean, he committed horrible crimes. He murdered. Well, rather, as it started at the beginning, he committed adultery, fathered a child, and then tried to cover it up by murdering the husband of the wife with whom he had committed adultery to try to make things look legitimate. And even David the king could not and was not exempt from the consequences of natural law. Fortunately, and to his credit, when he was confronted by the prophet Nathan, he made short work. He made short work where he could have come up with a litany of excuses and said, "I have sinned." And then things became, relatively easy. Verse 1, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the multitude of your tender mercies. Blot out my transgression, wash me thoroughly from my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin." It doesn't sound like David thought that the Ten Commandments had no social purpose. He recognized the gravity of his situation and knew that he was dependent on divine providence in order to regain his liberty and life and maybe a little bit of happiness. I mean, if you read the history, David's extended family, because he violated a number of the Ten Commandments, was not a big happy family. "I acknowledge my transgression and my sin is ever before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight, that you may be found just when you speak and blameless when you judge." To not acknowledge that our abortion our homosexuality, our birth out of wedlock, our promiscuity, our lack of going back to Christian principles without acknowledging that that is wrong leads to tyranny, because sin enslaves. It does not lead to liberty. If we do not appeal to divine providence and God's mercy, we will naturally become enslaved. David recognized this. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. Behold, you desire truth in the inward parts. Not what, you know, what you profess to be. What we profess to be, I mean, anybody that has a measure of communication skills can profess to be something. You know, you've probably heard the expression, you have to be a fool not to be able to come up with an excuse. Most excuses are, well, some form of denial or a lie. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me hear joy and gladness, that the bones which you have broken may rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out my iniquities. I mean, this is a declaration of dependence on divine providence. David understood, as did, you know, remember the, let me go back and quote the prayer that opened the proceedings to our founding Congress. Look down in mercy, we beseech you, on these American states who have fled to thee from the rod of the oppressor and have thrown themselves on thy gracious protection, desiring to be henceforth dependent only on thee. I mean, this is almost synonymous with what David wrote in Psalm chapter 51. It was a treatise of dependence on divine providence. It is by nature a dependent relationship that, in contrast to human relationships that are co-dependent, leads not to unhealthy relationships, but rather to life and liberty. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me. David had experienced firsthand, through a few narrow escapes, you know, when Saul tried to pin him literally against the wall with a spear, what happens to an individual who, once having had God's Spirit, when it departs from them. So in his declaration of dependence on divine providence, he pleads with God to not take away the Spirit from him. Restore to me the joy of your salvation, and uphold within me your generous spirit. Then I will teach transgressors your ways, and sinners shall be converted to you. I believe David is still doing that to this day. Because this chapter, this example, David's sin and David's subsequent repentance provides encouragement to all the malefactors of our time. Because if David could be forgiven and reconciled, I would be challenged to come up with a more egregious situation than that of David. And yet God was merciful because he depended on divine providence. Deliver me from blood guiltiness, O God, the God of my salvation, and my tongue shall sing aloud of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth shall show forth your praise. For you do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offerings. The sacrifice of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. We need an impossible combination of contriteness and boldness. We need to be contrite and open and honest when it comes to the inevitable failures that we make as human beings. And bold as a lion when it comes to standing for the truth that have slipped away over the past 50 years. And if we ever become so cowardly as to not stand strong for marriage and not stand strong for against alternative lifestyles, we will just reap the consequences. And yet, unless we make a concerted effort as an organization, as individuals to do that, we were just going to be swept away by the cultural currents of society. Do good in your good pleasure to Zion. Build the walls of Jerusalem, that you shall be pleased with the sacrifices of righteousness, with the burnt offerings and whole burnt offerings. Then they shall offer bulls on your altar. Brethren, we are adrift in huge cultural change. It's been ongoing, as we read, going back to the 40s and the 50s, and the 60s in particular. And those who should have been concerned about it and would have been able to turn the tide didn't. Because we were complacent. And now we reap the consequences, and the cultural shift is accelerating. And mere tolerance is not going to tolerate those who differ from this cultural shift. And as natural law would have it, the day is soon coming when we can no longer be complacent, but must stand and declare where we stand. You see, that's just how such dynamics work. So we have a choice to make. Do we, like David, throw ourselves upon the mercies of divine providence and become dependent upon it? Or do we, as humanists, or as humans would always tend to do, declare our independence from divine providence, and as a consequence, live in tyranny? It's a big choice that each individual has to make, and we will be forced to make it at some point. So since we have time, and since we have free will, I encourage all of us to, with David, declare our dependence on divine providence.